And I'd like to thank everybody who helped open the meeting by reading. And I'm going to turn the meeting over to Lisa to introduce the speaker. All yours, Lisa.
Thank you, Jay. Hi, everyone. I'm an addict. My name is Lisa.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello,
Lisa.
Oh, Lisa.
Hello,
Lisa, Lisa.
Hi, guys. I'm very happy and privileged to announce our speaker this evening. I met this lady when she asked me to do to share a meeting in Dubai, a women's meeting in Dubai, which was a great privilege as well. And it was a lovely meeting. It was really nice to kind of meet her. And I just remember her share was beautiful. And she told this story and it just left me with such a feeling of gratitude for, you know, enjoying the moment and, you know, that kind of idea. So I'm going to turn it over to her. And Joanne, you can share your experience, strength and hope with us for 45 minutes, whatever you're comfortable with. Take it away. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm an addict. My name is Joanne.
Hi, Joanne.
Hello, Joanne. Welcome.
Welcome. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lisa. I'm trying to remember what the heck I shared in that meeting. Really grateful to be here. It's definitely a new platform for me and, used to seeing the faces and all that. So definitely an adjustment. On the one hand, I like it because when you're facing people on Zoom, it's like you always see your own face as well. And it's really distracting and you can get quite sucked into this whole, do I look okay? Crap, you know? And I like this, although it's just strange to be talking to no one, although I know you're there. So bear with me. I will try my best to share my experience, strength, and hope. 40 to 45 minutes sounds like a horribly long time to talk, but we'll see. I was sitting here thinking about, a gentleman at the beginning asked me what my clean date was, and I was thinking about it after, and I was saying, the biggest thing about having more time is trying to remember all the way back. It's further and further away, but the good news is that, for me anyway, there's been a lot of life and there's been a lot of life lessons, a lot of ups and downs and a lot of opportunity to learn. And I'm really grateful that I've been able to, to stay clean and to live this life. I got clean when I was 25 and I'm now 51 and, it's been an incredible journey. And I know when I got clean, I never had any intention of, a lifetime of being clean. It was, I just wasn't even thinking of a future at that point in my life. When I was using, I was spending more time trying to die than I was trying to live. So I wasn't in a headspace when I got clean to think about, my whole life or spending a whole life clean and what that could mean for me and all those beautiful things that it is to me now. I certainly wasn't thinking about that then. I'll share a little bit of my experience. Most of what I like to talk about is, recovery, but for identification, I'll share a little bit of my story. I was born in Canada. I'm from Canada. I live in Dubai now, but I'm from Canada, and that's where I spent most of my life. And how I tend to relate my story is how I felt. And so I was adopted Not that that's a bad thing, but and I may have had the same feelings had I not been adopted, but I link it, you know, somewhat to being adopted and, you know, always feeling like I didn't fit in my family. And it wasn't just because I was adopted. My brother was always also adopted and he seemed just fine. But I felt like I was completely different. I was the black sheep in the family. And I just never felt, I always had this feeling of being on the outside, alone in my head, wishing that everybody could read my thoughts, you know, and just, I don't know, it was like, I have this one memory. We had moved to a new city. And I remember sitting on the curb at the end of the driveway. I knew there was other children in the area. I was 9 years old. And I remember sitting there just wishing, like trying to will them to come to me and introduce themselves. Because there was no way I was going to go and, you know, knock on the door and say, hi, I'm new here. Like that was not going to happen. But just that memory of sitting there wishing that people would just come to me, that's really how it was in my head. It's like I wanted connection. I didn't know how to get it. And, you know, I was waiting for it to come to me. And, you know, I think that's why like my favorite reading is the Triangle of Self-Obsession, and where it talks about, you know, when we're born, we somebody's taking care of our every need. And at some point, people move away from that phase and they start to recognize they need to take care of themselves and their own needs. And as an addict, I didn't do that, right? I was still waiting for everybody to fulfill my needs for me, whether that be to connect with new people or to, you know, understand that I had experienced a trauma without me talking about it. Like all these, I was always looking for that. But there's a lot of little stories like that one with me sitting on the curb, but that's how I felt a lot of the time. And one of the feelings that I associate with most of my life is fear. And we talk in NA about that self-centered fear. And that was for me, the feeling that motivated everything, right? So, fear of being rejected meant that I lied all the time about who I was. I couldn't be honest. I was going to be who I needed to be in order to not be rejected with my parents, with friends, in school, at work. It was, you know, be whoever, wear the mask that is necessary so that they will think you're who they want you to be. In the case of my parents, they, you know, in my mind, they wanted the perfect little girl. So it meant that I lied, I manipulated, I did all kinds of things to be able to live the life of the perfect little girl. But, you know, I was also wanted to be part of the popular crowd at school. So I clearly was not behaving in the way my parents wanted me to behave. So I had to hide that. You know, so all these little pieces of my life were all completely hidden in masks. And so we, like a lot of addicts, I felt alone a lot of the time and in a place of constantly juggling. I look back on that time in my life before getting clean, and it's, to me now, it's like mentally exhausting. Like all that pretending, all that lying and manipulating, trying to remember what I lied about to who and where I was supposed to be and what I was supposed to be doing. And, you know, at the point where I came near my bottom, it's like all the lies just started to crumble. You know, you get to this point in your using where you can't manage it anymore. So you're juggling and you're starting to drop the balls and like the facade is starting to crack. And that's really what it was for me. And, you know, so I started using, and I would say like my first experience, was with the drug of alcohol. I think I was in, I was like 12 years old maybe. And, you know, it was not a great experience. I was at a party at the, you know, kids of my friend's parents, kids of my parents' friends. So, you know, my parents were going to be coming to get me, and like this was family stuff, but there was alcohol there, and I drank and I drank and I drank because I was uncomfortable. I didn't know. So I just kept, this is what I kept doing. I'd get a drink, I'd sit down, I'd drink it, I'd get back up and get another, like back and forth and back and forth because I was uncomfortable. And then I threw up all over the floor in front of all these strangers, and it was horrifying. You know, so you would think that that would stop me, but it, I did not walk away from that experience saying I would never do that again, you know? I would say though, before I picked up in that way, when I looked back, when I came into recovery and I looked back at my life, there was, I would say probably sugar was my first addiction. And it wasn't that I liked sugar, you know, so I would like sweets and treats and things like that. I would eat it out of the bowl. I would make icing and eat it like it. And I did that when no one was around. And so while at that, when that was happening, and I was like a little kid at that time, I didn't think anything of it then. It was just, I like this. It makes me feel good. Mom wouldn't like it if she saw me eating this, so I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna sneak it. But when I came into recovery and I looked back on that, you know, I could see that pattern of, you know, looking for something to change how I'm feeling, which sugar absolutely did, and, you know, compulsively having it and not being able to stop and hiding it, right? So it was like a complete picture for me of addiction. Now that I look back, I can see all those things. But at the time, I was just, you know, trying to do whatever I could to change the way I felt. And so that played out in many ways. It played out in my using. It played out in men, relationships, you know, shopping, spending money. I got into huge debt before I was, I think I was 18, you know, just getting like a whole bunch of credit cards and racking up more than $10,000 in debt, just buying and buying, you know, and this just, you know, seemed like a stupid choice when I looked back on it at the time. And, you know, I had to pay the consequences that time. But it wasn't, you know, again, until recovery that I started to see those patterns that had shown up before I picked up and during my using. And so for me, using was a period in my life where I really was doing everything I could to escape how I felt, and to try and escape the fear. Right. If I was using, I was able to do things that I wouldn't be able to do clean, that would stop me from being rejected. So when I was, you know, near the end of my using, I was in and out of the psych ward, mostly for overdosing or suicide attempts. And I spent a fair bit of time in there. And, you know, When I found Narcotics Anonymous, I was in the psych ward. I had met a guy, and, you know, it's funny to me now that this was what I thought was a good place to get involved in a relationship. So now the good news was the guy that I met there was actually there getting clean. And he was going out on a pass a few nights a week. His mother would come and take him to a meeting. And so one night they asked if I wanted to join them. And I didn't know anything about really, no understanding of what he was really doing with this and what these meetings were about. But I knew his mother was a recovering alcoholic and she went to that fellowship. But she was taking him to NA. So I thought, hey, a night out, you know, that's kind of nice. So I went along, not knowing what to expect and not thinking that I needed to be there. I wasn't even really thinking about it, but I went to my first NA meeting. And I don't recall a lot of the, you know, the readings or anything like that, but I remember that incredible feeling of connection, of hearing people say things that I had going on in my head, and thinking for the first time that I didn't feel alone. You know, I felt like maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe, you know, it's more than just me. And then they were so welcoming. I was very fortunate that, you know, it was a live meeting, obviously. And the people at that meeting really pushed the women to the women, right? So I was still in that space of, I connect better with guys. Like, I don't really connect with women. I don't, you know, feel comfortable around women. And so, you know, I'm trying to talk to the guys after the meeting, and they're like, here, let me introduce you to my friend, Kathy. And, oh, you need a ride home. I think Owen could maybe take you home. Let me get you, let me introduce you. And they were giving me all these women's phone numbers. I really felt like, I don't know why, but I think I might come back here, you know? Things got a little crazy right after that. I was sadly kicked out of the psych ward for smoking in the bathroom too many times. And, you know, and I joke about it now because, like, it's not the place to go to pick up a guy. It's not really good when you're kicked out of there. You know, it's pretty sad. But, you know, at the same time, it really brought me to Narcotics Anonymous. So I found myself kicked out of there in the middle of the night, and I went to a hotel nearby, and I was just desperately trying to get something to use. And I was supposed to be, doing something the next day, but I was just like, it was a complete mess. And I found myself going to another Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And and that started my journey in Narcotics Anonymous. I started to listen. I met a girl who became my first sponsor. And I started to really get involved. And, you know, it was the fellowship I was in fairly large, I guess, fellowship, but very, everything was kind of close. It was a city that wasn't too big, so you could go to the noon meeting and go for coffee and then walk to the evening meeting. And so you could literally spend your whole day with addicts. And that's what my early recovery was like. I didn't quite get it at first. I thought that, you know, it meant I wasn't using certain things, but, you know, the medications, some of the medications that I was taking were okay. And that was okay for a while, because I was starting to get the message. And, you know, I found this first sponsor, and she was so gentle and loving. And I was such a mess, you know, so I really, really appreciated, that nurturing feeling, that kindness. And I remember I went to my first meeting alone, and it was a candlelight meeting in a church basement, and someone was celebrating 5 years. And I thought to myself, wow. 5 years, that is, like, to me, that was insane. It was just such a huge number. And I remember, you know, at that meeting feeling almost like this spiritual feeling, you know, a lot had to do with the candlelight, but it was the sharing, you know. And so this woman with 5 years, you know, and people are sharing these things about her, these beautiful stories about her, and she's sharing a bit about her experience, and I'm trying to put together in my head the image that's being presented of her when she first got clean to who I'm seeing before me at 5 years clean. And it was two very different people. And, you know, that's kind of when I started to see that this could potentially be a good thing for me. This maybe there's hope for me. And, you know, I really have always loved celebrations. You know, that was the first one I saw. But there was just such a magic in celebrations for me. And they're not everybody loves them. My husband does not really like them so much, other than as a way of showing people that the program works. But for me, it's magical. I love it. I love seeing the change year after year and celebrating it. So, you know, that's really my journey started there. I got a sponsor. I was going to meetings. I hadn't quite got it, but you know, it was getting there. That guy that I met in the psych ward, we moved in together. Mistake number two, but you know, we learn from our mistakes. Anyways, his mother was about to celebrate 17 years in recovery, and she wanted to take him on a trip, and he relapsed right before that. So she took me, and you know, we left. We went to Mexico for 2 weeks. And, you know, it was, I remember being there, and it was, you know, we weren't staying in like high, you know, big expensive resorts. We were like in these little hotels, and it was a really magical trip we did. We traveled around different parts of Mexico. We met some people, and I remember we'd been there maybe a week, and we're sitting in the evening eating at this restaurant on the beach. And I said, her name was Kathy. I said, Kathy, I feel different. Like, I don't know what it is. I feel really different. She said, are you maybe happy? And I'm like, you know, I had this moment of, yeah, that is what I'm feeling, right? I'm feeling some happiness. I'm feeling some joy, and I'm not accustomed to it. Like, it was so, that was like a little awakening for me that this is possible, you know? At that time, I think I still believed that, you know, happiness was something you achieved and then, you know, everything was going to be okay. You got clean and life got better. I hadn't really understood that, you know, you come, you work a program, you practice principles that help you to get through difficult times with less pain, with less struggle, you know, but the difficult times still come. I hadn't understood that point. Not at that time, but I did start to understand that life didn't have to be as heavy as I thought it was, you know, that there was moments of happiness that could be there without using, like I didn't have to use to feel happiness. And what an incredible gift that was, you know. That trip, I was so grateful to that woman. She passed away a few years later. She relapsed maybe a year after that trip. And that was really hard because that was, you know, probably the first time that I saw that someone could be clean for a long time and still not make it. And you know, I had to also understand that there was a reason why, you know, that was just, you know, it was a lesson I had to come to understand is that, being clean for a period of time does not exclude me from having to continue to practice the program. At no point do I become different from everybody else, unless I separate myself. And so, anyways, we went on that trip not long after I met someone in the program. I would say dating, but we weren't dating. I mean, I took him home and he never left, kind of thing. But he was in recovery as well. He had about a year and a half when I met him, and I was, you know, a few months. And then I went off to treatment, and I came back, and I found out that while I was gone, he had cheated on me, and I ended up using. And I share all this, you know, if anyone here is new, I don't know who's here and who's new and who's not, but if anyone here is new, I share this story not because it is my story, it is what happened. And it was against all the recommendations. Obviously, we don't recommend getting in relationships in early recovery, but I did. And I learned the why that was, you know, relationships. And what I learned is that relationships bring up a lot of big feelings, you know, some beautiful and fun, amazing feelings. That honeymoon phase is amazing, and that can certainly distract you from the pain and challenges of getting clean, right? So great feelings, but it also has big, hard feelings. So when something doesn't go right and you're in early recovery, the pain of those emotions is really hard to handle. So I didn't know how to handle the anger. I've never, you know, I was never taught in my family to deal with anger. We, you know, my parents always had this agree to disagree kind of way of dealing with things. And so I like anger, confrontation, like I was never comfortable with that. It scared me. So, you know, one of the ways that I had always dealt with it previously was by using. And that's what I did. But I this is when I had my first spiritual awakening. I remember when I was, you know, contemplating using. I remember I can even picture where I was walking down the street and thinking to myself, you know, F you, God, I'm taking this back and I'm using. And that's when I realized that I had made a choice, you know, and it was, you know, this moment of complete clarity that I was making a choice, that no one was making me use. It wasn't because of him. It wasn't because of anything other than me not wanting to sit in the feelings that I had and choosing to use and literally taking my will back and making that choice. And prior to that, you know, when we were in, I was in treatment and, you know, someone had come in like on our last day of treatment, it was like someone who had gone through the program before, an alumni, and she was sharing how about one in four don't make it. One in four make it. So, you know, we're looking around at each other and thinking, that's not very good odds, like which one of us is going to make it? So I walked away from treatment with this impression that, you know, relapse is inevitable. And it can just happen to you, like you slipped on a banana and you got high kind of thing. And so when this happened, when I realized that I had made that choice, unfortunately I used. Gratefully, I didn't die and I came back. But I came back with a full sense of understanding that to use or not to use was my choice. Yes, I have a disease of addiction, but I have all the power to stop myself from using if I use the tools of recovery. So I never used again after that, and that was my clean date of April 18th, 1996. And, you know, just so grateful that I learned that lesson and I lived through that lesson, because from that point on, I knew that there was no good reason to use. So even when things were really crappy, like I knew if I used, I couldn't blame it on anything anymore. I would have to say, I used because I didn't want to feel this way. I used because I didn't want to go through this. But in every scenario, I had to admit that I chose to do it. So sometimes just that knowledge kept me from using. Anyways, I didn't end that relationship with that guy. And very shortly after I got clean, probably around that same day, I got pregnant. So there I was, you know, with very little clean time in a relationship and pregnant. So that was in April, and in early June, I took a job in another city. So I did, you know, I got in a relationship, I got pregnant, I moved to another city, and I started a new job. So I packed in a lot of the things that I had been suggested not to do in early recovery. I don't regret those things because I'm very grateful for the life I have today. And had I not made those choices, I wouldn't have the life I had today. But I can say that it made recovery harder. It made, it distracted me from the things that I probably should have been working on, like step work, like, you know, taking some time to heal myself, to get to a place where I could be, you know, a better version in a relationship. But I didn't do that. He moved with me to this new city. There we set off against everybody's recommendations. No, don't have the baby. No, don't you, this was never going to work. And this was coming from his side, from my side, his sponsor, like, you know, it was, so I can say for sure, as someone who's quite stubborn, that some of that just fueled me to, you know, make it work no matter what. And we joke about that because there's definitely times in our relationship that's how we managed to stay, because it was hard. You know, he had a year and a half more than me, which a year and a half clean is, you know, early recovery. We were having a baby. We had no clue how to take care of ourselves. And we were bringing this baby into the world. And we were very, you know, intent on making sure that we did our best with that. And, you know, the thing with one addict, you know, you come with that baggage from your life experience, the baggage of using, of abuse, if you've had abuse, or all that stuff, and it's all there with you. And then I had this partner who had all his baggage, and then we had a little baby, and, you know, and it was hard. We were in a new city, I moved there thinking the fellowship, it was a bigger city. So this was Toronto, Canada. I thought it would just be a bigger version of what I had in the city where I got clean, in Ottawa. And it was a very different fellowship. They, you know, had been going through some growing pains, and so it was very different. And it was an adjustment, and I wasn't as excited to go to meetings on top of being pregnant, on top of then having a little infant in them, you know, and being exhausted all the time and all that. But, you know, after a couple of months of trying to adjust to it, you know, I found my home group. At least I was doing the basics. I had my sponsor, I started to get on in my recovery a little bit. The big thing that I did right away was get involved in service. And this is kind of a theme in my recovery, because service has often been what has saved me, has kept me connected to the fellowship. I've moved a fair bit in recovery, and I'm very grateful for that. I've had a lot of, you know, really interesting opportunities. And with that, though, comes that feeling of being a newcomer every time you move, right? You don't know anybody, they don't know who you are, and you feel like a newcomer. And you know, for me, I'm still shy. I'm still, you know, hoping that someone will say, oh, you look new, but you don't look like a newcomer. Who are you? You know, just please come up to me. But that's not really how it works. And so I've used service a lot, as a way, to give back, because that's, you know, I was told by my first sponsor and my second sponsor, like, we do service. That's what we do. It's not, do I want to, or do I not want to, which service am I going to do right now? And, but you know, it's been for me a great gift to connect with a fellowship through service. Whether it be on a, you know, as a GSR or something at the group level or working on a convention committee. I did a lot of that, and, you know, it's challenged me in many ways, but has been great for connection. And I would say service is actually one of the things that really helped me to build the career that I have. So yeah, we embarked on this journey. We had our baby, little girl, who's now 25. And we got married shortly after she was born, and grateful, and, you know, still somewhat shocked. We just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary this summer. Both still in recovery, and still very committed to it. And, you know, relationships, such a huge challenge. And, you know, I can definitely say, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I am really proud that, you know, we've managed to keep this relationship and to grow in it. And, you know, it's not been all good. It's been complete shit at times. And the big thing that has always, I guess, kept us moving forward is that we have this fellowship that is there for us when we need it. A big thing that we did in early recovery, I remember we were going to meetings, and we were like going to the meetings together at first. And I remember one meeting, you know, we're sitting there next to each other, and he took my hand, and it was like we both realized at the same time, like, what are we doing? This is not a date. Meetings are not dates. And from then on, we didn't go to meetings together. We always had our separate meetings after that, and we had our separate home groups. And, you know, the really good point was when some people didn't even realize we were a couple, because that allowed me to be Joanne, the addict in recovery, and he was Clay, the addict in recovery, and it wasn't Joanne and Clay, because that, you know, being the couple in a fellowship or in an area can put a lot of pressure on the relationship, and on, you know, people put the relationship, not just the people, but the relationship on a pedestal, which is, you know, can be really, really hard on a relationship. I know for myself, I say offense. It scares me if anybody puts me on a pedestal, because of clean time or because of whatever it is. Like, I have to remember all the time that I'm an addict just like everybody else. When I'm sitting in a meeting, I'm no different. You know, I have different things to share. I have different experiences, but I'm no better, no worse. I am the same as every other addict in that room. And I need that connection to feel the same. So it was really a really important part to me that our relationship not be, you know, seen that way, and that I not be put on a pedestal at any time. And there was a point when I was about, say, 19 years clean. I was in a really bad place. I hadn't gone to meetings a lot in that in that time. I was traveling a lot for work, and that was my excuse. I couldn't find a home group because I didn't want to commit to something and not be there because I traveled so much. And really, it was just a case of, you know, I had, I wasn't prioritizing my recovery. I'd forgotten almost that if I didn't prioritize my recovery, I would end up with nothing. And it came close. It's not that I had using thoughts, but I definitely had using behavior. And that's, you know, using behavior will use to lead to using for me. So, you know, at that point in my recovery, I'm 19 years clean, and it's really, really hard to say, guys, I'm really messed up. You know, I'm not behaving well in my marriage. I had stepped out of my marriage. I had started smoking again, which is not like smoking is not for me. That was a using behavior because I was using it as a way to change my feelings and to separate myself. I just was not behaving according to the principles of recovery, and I was blaming it all on my partner, almost all, and justifying it, right? And that was the disease in my head, saying, you're totally justified in this, you know? You're this, and he's that, and I could justify it in my mind, which is a scary thing about the disease, the way that we can justify our behaviors and really believe that this is true. And that's where I was in my recovery at 19 years clean. And it was really hard for me to say, like, I need help. I'm not in a good place here. And it had to, it got really, like, I had to get to a point of desperation. And I did. And I got to that point of desperation. And I had to commit to doing 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, it was an incredible gift to go to meetings and to share honestly about everything that had happened, to tell my, you know, my close friends, my sponsor, like share everything. And since that point in my recovery, I have felt this freedom of being myself, that I can tell anything to anyone. I am no longer living in that fear. And up until that 19 years, you know, there was things that had happened along the way in recovery that, yes, I told my sponsor, and yes, maybe my husband knew, but I wasn't feeling, I never felt that comfort to tell, you know, my close friends in recovery. Like, I still walked around for a long time with that fear that if people really know me, like really know me, everything, even then, especially anything that I did wrong in recovery, like there's no way they're going to love me, you know? And so at 19 years clean, that myth was squashed. And I found out that not only did people still love me, I felt this freedom that I could never have imagined. And I was helping people. Like, that's when I realized that if I'm not being honest in a meeting, if I'm not sharing what's truly going on, and I'm talking about the ugly stuff and the good stuff, then, you know, I'm not helping that other person who's sitting in the room thinking, I can't share this because they won't love me. So now I've learned that lesson, and I have to continue to do that. I have to show up and be myself, the good, the bad, and at least let that other person who might be sitting in the room thinking that they are not good enough, that they're not doing recovery right, or that they can't possibly love because they did this or they did that. You know, I have the ability. That's why, you know, we sit there and share, is to help each other. And I can't help anyone if I'm not being honest. And I can't have real relationships if I'm not being honest. You know, truly understanding the spiritual principles and that practicing them meant literally doing them, you know, like an athlete practices their sport to get better. I have to practice honesty. I have to practice caring and kindness and compassion and empathy and integrity and courage. And I have to do that regularly. Like every day, I have to practice those principles so that I get better at them. Honesty was the hardest one for me because I had always pretended to be something different. And, you know, I think at one point I thought, well, yeah, but I'm not lying like to hurt someone, or I'm not, you know, like, I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to be loved, or I'm trying, you know, not to hurt someone or whatever it is. And like, I had to really take the time through the step work and through, you know, listening to others to understand all these different layers of honesty. It wasn't just about telling the truth about this one particular thing. It was like, it was everything. It was like when my husband asks me, what movie do you want to watch? And I don't care. You pick. Well, that's lying. Because I did care. I do want to watch something. I have choices and I have, you know, there's things that I like. But I didn't want to answer, because if he didn't want what I wanted and he did it anyway, then he might be miserable. And then that would ruin my experience. Like, it's complete bullshit. But those are the types of things that went through my mind. And it took a long time for me to realize that that was dishonesty. Right? So I needed to learn to practice that. So if you ask me what I want for dinner, I'm going to say, you know what? What I actually want is pizza. Maybe that's not what we're going to have, but you asked me and that's what I want. And it's still hard for me today. You know, that's making a decision is hard for me because it requires me to be honest with myself and with others. And so, yeah, the spiritual principles, though, are something that I fell in love with over the past few years. Like, it's just like, in any situation, I can ask myself, what principle can I apply here? Like, it's a literal toolkit for me to use in order to have the happiness I want, right? And learning that I can be happy in the moment, no matter what's going on. And I don't mean joyful. That's something completely different. But, you know, I don't have to be unhappy. I don't have to be miserable. My sponsor will always says to me, like, you know, you're entitled to as much misery as you want. So, you know, here's what I suggest you do. But, you know, if you you can do what you want. And I've learned that I don't want to be miserable. And in order to not be miserable, I can apply the program in all my affairs. And, you know, it's not easy, but it certainly makes my life easier. You know, I can today, I can get up in the morning, I can go for a walk, and I can appreciate the things around me. You know, when I was using, I could have gone on that same walk and seen nothing but misery, right? Because I had no ability to live in the moment, to enjoy what I had, and, you know, to have that ability to have gratitude for the small things. And when I do that, everything seems so much better. I don't know how I am on time. I think I've gone quite long. What I will, you know, wrap up with is that it talks in our literature about living a life beyond our wildest dreams. Like I said earlier, I came in not expecting anything. You know, I wasn't looking at my life in terms of, you know, dreams and what I hoped and anything like that. I was like just getting through the day. And, you know, I mentioned to a couple of you at the beginning, you know, I'm living in Dubai. You know, I got clean in Canada. We transferred to Chile in South America. for a time, and then we transferred here to Dubai. And in 3 weeks, approximately, on December 1st, we're transferring to Paris, which is a personal dream of mine. You know, and the thing is that this is all these transfers. This is from my career, like from me, from the work that I've done. And, you know, it's nothing that I could have imagined that I could achieve, you know, to build a career, to be able to move around the world, and to have these adventures and to take my partner with me on them. And we have this, you know, beautiful daughter who lives in Canada because she's, you know, she's 25, she has her life. But, you know, the gifts just keep coming, and I can have all these things and be miserable, or I can have all these things and be grateful. And I'm incredibly grateful, you know, that my life went from something so small to, it's like huge. My life is just, it's big, it's exciting. And that's because I choose that, you know, I choose recovery. I choose to practice the program. And I'm incredibly grateful for it. I just really, really grateful for this program and for all of you who share this journey with me. So I think I'll leave it at that. If you're new, if that sounded like a lot, it is a lot. So keep coming back, because the gifts just keep on coming if you're opening yourself up to them through the program. So thank you for letting me share. I'm really, really grateful to be here and to experience this meeting.